Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and you're listening to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before we introduce today's guest, I want to be sure that we thank our sponsor, OneCause. OneCause is the leader in online, mobile, and virtual fundraising software. OneCause supports over 6,000 nonprofits to reach more and raise more with innovative solutions. You can visit their virtual fundraising resource center at www.onecause.com. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's 12-month recovery plan that we've been collaborating on for the last several weeks with several of our most trusted colleagues in the fundraising space. We are very grateful to Jennifer Harris, Andrew Olson, Teresa Lee, as well as our friends at OneCause and iWave for contributing to this plan. This resource is available to you for free. All you have to do is go to our website at www.responsivefundraising.com/recovery plan and download it. I will also be sure to include a link in the show notes. Now let's introduce today's guest. Hi, Jason. Thank you for being my guest today on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We've had a few minutes to familiarize ourselves with each other, and I'm looking forward to this conversation. But before we do that, how about you just introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Jason. I'm really inspired by the work that you're doing, and it's an honor to be here. I have been a fundraiser for over 20 years now, and mostly with prominent large nonprofits, and I'm currently working for the best organization that I've ever worked for. It's called the Unique Foundation, and we help young women. We inspire hope in young women who have been sexually abused as children or adolescents. And I'm the main fundraiser down here in Atlanta, Georgia.
Yeah, so that's an interesting organization. So are you serving women in the Atlanta metro area or around the country, and are you raising money in the general in the region, or are you raising money around the country?
Yes, sir. Well, I am raising money around the country. So There's another major gifts director, and he's in Utah. And this organization is based out of Lehigh, Utah.
Okay.
Derek and Shalane Maxfield decided to start something that they really were excited about. They had more questions about why are women blaming themselves for their abuse, if that makes sense. And it just didn't make sense to them. So they started the organization. I've come on as the major gift director down here in Atlanta, but I have contacts all over the country. So doing my best to get out to them and raise money for, we have a retreat here in Atlanta, or not in Atlanta, but in Georgia, up in the woods. And then we also have a retreat in Utah, and they're both within a day's driving distance. So we set it up that way specifically so that people could drive or fly easily into the areas where we have the retreats.
So is it a resident? I have to imagine it's a residential program, help me piece this together.
Sure. I'm sorry, I'm not being clear, but it's a 4-day retreat. So
okay.
Clinically, we have a fantastic clinical team, and they've researched, and those 4 days are really impactful. Then we have 12 weeks of online courses that the women move into, and that's about as good as about 40 weeks, I believe, of total psychotherapy. So about 13 weeks is where we've got it condensed down to. And then we've set up, and this is the amazing thing, we set up community groups. So they're peer-run community groups where the women can just engage with each other. And it's kind of like a model of Alcoholics Anonymous. So,
okay.
Yeah, absolutely wonderful.
Fascinating. Fascinating, Jason. Well, and you and I could probably go down that path. I've been involved with other types of organizations with similar missions in the past, but we'll stay on subject for today. Jason, I think you and I were going to talk about just the importance of relationships and what you have learned in the last 20 so years about how important it is to have meaningful relationships. Does that sound about right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah. So how about you unpack that for us?
Sure. Well, to be honest with you, Jason, you know, I came from a pretty tough background myself. I've had some challenges in life. I was very privileged and had the opportunity to go to Georgetown University and started experiencing some mental health issues there, i.e. depression, and didn't realize what that was all about. I had been totally successful in life and never had any problems at all. And then all of a sudden, my senior year at Georgetown, I just went in the tank. And so I struggled for many years because I didn't want to admit that I was having problems, first of all. And then I was trying to solve the problems on my own. So I say all that to say that when I'm, you know, I didn't mean to become a fundraiser. I believe it was divine and it was an opportunity for me to get back to other people. And that's been about the only thing that has inspired me in life, you know, except for my family and my friends. But taking the time to help another individual, there's nothing better than that. So fundraising was dropped in my lap as a result of my recovery from depression and the subsequent alcohol I was using to actually cope. So I ended up getting clear of all that. And then I was offered a fundraising opportunity with the Salvation Army. Uh-huh. Right in my pipeline. I could go in and speak the language. I'd never raised a dollar in my life, but I went in and just told people what this is about, you know, what addiction's about, what alcoholism is about, what mental health issues are about. And it gave me the opportunity to really be genuine. And out of the gate, I was basically, I did really well. And I wasn't expecting that either. But I had some amazing guidance by my director of development, Ernst Bauer. And this was at the Salvation Army in San Francisco, California. But it was just a genuine outreach that I was doing. And people can sense, the donors can sense when I'm genuine. And that's probably been the most beautiful thing that people have said about me throughout my career, is I take the time to really get to know who the donors are. I do a ton of research. There's a gentleman that wrote a book, you know, I'll go in and read their books and just have a lot of information that I can connect with them genuinely. And people sense that. So I think when I say meaningful relationships, it's like I'm speaking from a personal place. And I believe that a lot of people in nonprofits come from something, or we all have our own struggles. And once you are able to overcome those struggles, you can speak from a very, very genuine place. And that's the beauty of fundraising.
I have oftentimes thought this, and I don't know that I've articulated it particularly well. And I don't even know that in the 160 episodes of this podcast that we've even talked about it in this particular way. But so the fundraising space has been talking about mental health, and we've been talking about some of these challenges that you're describing that are part of your own journey. Yes. And one of my earliest guests on here, for example, she talked a lot about imposter syndrome, and she's been keynoting around the country on the subject. And I kind of wonder if the silver lining in these I guess we could call them brokenness that a lot of us have experienced actually makes us better fundraisers. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah. You know, I wouldn't be here if I didn't go through my challenges, and I believe it was part of a bigger plan. for me to see things up close. You know, I ended up homeless for 2 years, and I saw a lot of the issues up close that I'm actually fundraising for. So I don't really tell people that when I'm fundraising, and sometimes I do just to be genuine and let them know my story. But yeah, I believe that fundraisers are amazing. They're amazing people to take the time to want to go out and do a tough job in order to help another individual have a better life. And that has become my sole purpose. And it actually brought me out of my brokenness, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So am I hearing that fundraising essentially has become a part of your recovery process?
Yes, sir. Sure has. And I sure am grateful for it, because it gives me a chance to do something meaningful with life and inspires me to get up every morning and to do the things that I need to do as far as self-care is concerned in order to present myself to the community as, you know, a genuine person.
So does that mean, okay, so I'm reading a book right now. It's an older book by a guy by the name of Edward Hall, and he talks about how human beings have a tendency in our culture, what is human? He's talking about what he calls extensions and how we rely on extensions. So in a very modern sense, an extension would be like the laptop or the cell phone in our hand. It's all these things, these tools that we use to sort of extend who we are as human beings. But what he also talks about in the book with these extensions is the idea that essentially they dehumanize us, and they sort of take on a life of their own. So we allow the computer or the cell phone or whatever extension or tool we're using to sort of assume, almost as if they begin to take responsibility for all this.
Right.
And so how do I loop this back to what I'm hearing you talk about and some of the writing that I'm doing? I think part of what fundraising is guilty of is we've been relying on these extensions for so long. And then some of us have experienced fundraising without all those extensions, which is to say you've sat across the lunch table with an individual and actually had a real meaningful human to human conversation. And I'm guessing that's been where that recovery has happened for you. Am I right?
Yes, sir. You know, the moment that I'm able to build a relationship, well, to be honest with you, the phone has really helped me build confidence in myself.
Okay.
I pick up the telephone, and at first, when I was first told to do it, I was so nervous.
Sure.
Kind of like I am on this podcast, but that's all right.
You're doing fine.
But, you know, picking up the telephone and having just a minute to really express who I am in order to keep somebody's interest is basically all I'm given. So I say something meaningful at that moment on a phone conversation, and that's where I begin to build my relationships. And then once I'm able to get them at a dinner table or a lunch table or over coffee, then we can really get down to the brass tacks of, you know, what's gone on in my life and why they want to take the time to donate to an organization or even try to help another individual. Like, I do a lot of listening more than talking, to be honest with you. And
sure,
people tell me all kinds of stories, and they're just phenomenal how people come to a point where they want to give.
So in the process, I have to imagine that at that lunch table, you're finding, not only are you experiencing that recovery process that essentially has been 2 decades worth of recovery is what you're describing, but you're also experiencing a level of joy and pleasure in your work that I think, Jason, I think a lot of fundraisers are missing out on. So regardless of what our humanity is, regardless of what our broken sort of, you know, we're all broken, you know, individuals with,
yes,
we'll call them deficits, right?
Right.
Weaknesses or whatever. I think the further away we are from the donor, I think some of the challenges we have in this work is because the further away we are from that lunch table that you've experienced and a lot of my colleagues have, and anybody who knows me, that's what I've spent most of my career doing as well, as sitting across that lunch table. I don't think you can experience the joy in fundraising having not done that.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Some people don't like that. I mean, there's plenty of people who are, you know, entrenched in direct response, or they love putting on special events, or they write grants all day. But I'm just a guy who says, look, you've got to get in front of that donor to really experience what it means to be a fundraiser.
I fully agree with you, Jason. Those have been some of the most meaningful times in my entire life, is when I'm able to actually get to a point where I can go sit down with them and learn about their lives and why they want to give. I mean, there's just nothing more meaningful to me. And I really appreciate the work that you're doing, you know, in increasing what it means to be meaningful in fundraising. And you're totally correct in saying that, you know, building relationships is the most important thing that I've done with my life in order to help another human being. And I fully believe that you're right in saying that when you experience that with your work every day and you take advantage of how special that is and you realize how special that is, then you really become an excellent fundraiser. And I really enjoy your points.
Yeah. So, okay. So let's sit on that for a minute. How do you, okay. So here's a guy who's saying that fundraising has become a very meaningful career for him. You've worked in some pretty big shops. I certainly know the Salvation Army, but I have to imagine, Jason, some of this comes down to you also working for the right kind of bosses. Because I don't think there's and I just said this with a guest who I think it was my previous podcast guest. I don't think in our fundraising space we have a talent problem. I think we have a supervisor problem. And apparently I have to guess you've had some pretty good bosses.
Yes, sir. The very first person that I had as my mentor was a gentleman named Ernst Bauer. And he had come from the board of directors for the Salvation Army as they were getting ready to open up a Croc Center there in San Francisco, which was only the second one in the country. Ernst came from the business side. So he came in and is just a dynamic human being that took the time to show me how to fundraise. And the first thing that he did for me was come into the office and he was like, hey, pick up the phone. And it was from that moment that I really started to gain some confidence, you know, be a little bit more eloquent as I was learning how to place phone calls to people, and it helped develop my confidence as a human being. And he taught me so much about fundraising, and we had a blast together. And you're exactly right. You know, having the correct supervisor like Ernst, and it's amazing. It's been a long time between Ernst and what I have right now with the Unique Foundation. I'm allowed the same, I've been given the same dynamism by my supervisors, and they're just encouraging. They instill confidence in me. They let me know what it means to really help a survivor of, you know, child sexual abuse. And it's just, you're exactly correct. My supervisor at first was the one that taught me. I've been through some shops where it didn't really work out that well. It worked out well on everybody's accord. Like, we were able to raise money, but it wasn't as meaningful as, say, the current situation that I'm in.
Yeah, I see. And that's where I thought you were going to go. I think we've got bosses out there who want the guy in your seat, the guy in my seat, the guy in any of these seats, guy or gal, to bring in the money, but they do not have enough. They themselves have not been at that lunch table enough to know and experience what sort of creates that drive and that determination to get the job done. I think you've been at the lunch table enough to know that, I mean, you've been at that lunch table enough to know that you're going to basically at some point come back with a check. All the boss wants to know is that he or she wants the predictability of a check.
Right.
I've been researching another concept. I've been researching, and I'm trying to get into this new book, is this idea of serendipity. I think a guy like you is sitting at that lunch table with a confidence that says, I don't absolutely know what the outcomes are going to be of this meeting, but I trust that something serendipitous is going to happen, and that I'm okay with that. I'm like an explorer. You're going to get out, you're going to put your feet on the ground. You're going to sort of trudge through the jungle, and you're going to find something amazing. That, am I right?
Yes, sir. I was just thinking about the amount of fundraising that I've been in. We all know that sometimes our back is against the wall and we're trying to make things happen. And for me personally, sometimes I get scared, oh gosh, we're not going to be able to do this. Oh gosh, all those doubts and all those thoughts. And I'm able to break that cycle because of my personal healing. But in the organizations that I've produced the best gifts, like I am currently with Cynthia Gamble and Chris Yadden, these folks really care about me as an individual. So they're not too concerned about how much money I'm bringing in. Now, they do want a probability of the gift, but that only makes sense in tracking my relationships. So, my back's not against the wall. I'm a very happy-go-lucky person right now. And all they have to say to me is just kind, encouraging. It's going to take a little time, no pressure. And I'm able to reflect that with donors at the dinner table or the lunch table or coffee. I'm able to reflect that relaxed, like there's no pressure. So don't worry about me saying that you have to give this amount by today.
Yeah. So I have to imagine working with the organization that you do and having experienced your own sort of journey with mental health, the donor on the other side of that table, I have to imagine in a lot of cases has been through those same journeys. Am I right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We've all been through something, every single one of us on this planet, right? So
yeah,
we all have a meaningful story that connects us to want to give back to help another individual.
And in like how many out of 10 meetings does their story, their journey come up?
I hope 10. To be honest,
and do you you've sort of opened up and shared with me and our listeners, this is what I think I call it arm's length fundraising. I think some of our fundraisers are out there are so entrenched in what I call arm's length fundraising that they never sort of experienced this. So please help me unpack this for them. I think going in, before you even know their story, I think you intuitively know that they're going to tell you their story. Am I right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Exactly. Sometimes I lead off with my story, but that opens the gate to everybody relaxing and then opening up and being vulnerable. And that's the best part of fundraising right there, is just talking about life with a donor that has the capacity to change lives. And that's what I'm trying to do, and that's what they're trying to do, and we're talking about intimate things, and there's no better experience as far as work is concerned.
Okay, so you've been doing this long enough, you 5 years in or whatever, where was that point early in the process, 2, 3, 4, 5 years in, where it sort of clicked that this is the way that the job gets done?
From the very beginning for me.
Your job allowed you to sit at that lunch table from day one?
Yes. Yes. They put me out and, we were opening a building and it was going to be dedicated to the city of San Francisco. And my director of development just came in and I just came in and it was just all feet to the fire. Let's fundraise. And that's exactly what we did, but we did it.
Okay. And if you don't mind me asking, how old are you?
I'm 45.
Right. So you were like in your early 20s when you were doing this. So they put you in front of donors that probably were as old as your parents or your grandparents. Am I right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
and I think that's some of the genuineness. You just had to go. You just had to show up. Am I right?
That's right. That's right. And the only tools that I had were what I've been through and the challenges that I experienced and the things that I've overcome and the reason that I want to be a fundraiser and the reason that I want to help another individual. And then I get to hear all of that information from the donor. And if there's a check it's fantastic. But if there's not, you just learn something intimate about somebody, and it's just a fantastic experience.
Yeah, I remember I got to know, and that's kind of the way it's interesting, Jason, you're describing your first job. I landed in a similar job. When my wife and I, Erica and I, went to work for this children's home, and we went to work in the program, and we and our boss figured out very quickly that I was not particularly well suited for the program itself, rather than taking care of these kids like a house parent that I was supposed to be. I was more like a goofy big brother. and the development office opened up, and I didn't know what fundraising was at the time. My boss allowed me to get on the road, just like you're describing. He allowed me to get into the field, and I didn't know what I was doing, and I didn't know what to do and what not to do.
Right.
And I established some rapport and some trust with some key individuals. I remember a gentleman, Mr. Walter. I write about him in my first book. I remember meeting with him probably about once a quarter. We'd meet at this little steakhouse. This is the southwest corner of Virginia, in the mountains, and we'd meet at this little locally run steakhouse, and we'd meet about once a quarter and have those lunch table conversations. But I think what really clicked for me, Jason, was when it was right before Christmas, and Mr. Walters and his son walked through the front door of our office, and I think he had like a $10,000 check in his hand. And these two men, the Mr. Walters and his adult son, were just beaming, cheek to, they were red with joy and excitement or whatever. And $10,000 at the time, I mean, it's not that's a pretty big check for them. And it was a big check. It was a big check for us. And I think that was one of those moments where I realized, okay, this is what the work is.
exactly.
And I didn't even ask for that gift. I think Mr. Walters was probably one of those donors where every time you, took him out to lunch, he probably handed you a check, and it was probably, it could have been a couple hundred bucks or something. It was not extraordinary.
Right.
But when he came and there was I think this was one of them scenarios where he had to make a distribution from his IRA or something. And so he brought it to the children's home, and we, certainly warmly received it. But that was one of those, what kind of moments have you had like that?
Yes, sir. I mean, my moments have all been like that, to be honest with you. My very first occurrence was with a lady named Marcia Argyris, and she was the program director for the Bechtel Foundation in San Francisco. And that's a huge foundation. And I was a little intimidated, but she took the time to show me how to write a grant so that she could accept it on the other end, right? But this is how I learned how to fundraise. And it's just people like that in the community and in business taking the time to see that somebody really wants to learn and somebody really wants to help other people. I think they get a sense of that, and then all of a sudden they just give of themselves. And that's the way I've learned how to fundraise, is people taking the time to really care about me as an individual. And that's been my whole life. I mean, people have helped me through tough situations, and I'm just blessed to have an opportunity to be able to give that back in some sort of way. The numbers are staggering with childhood sexual abuse. It's staggering. 1 in 4 women are abused before the age of 18. And so I have an opportunity to go out there, raise money for these women that are trying to change their lives. And I don't think that there's anything more meaningful than that. And then I have bosses that or supervisors that give me the opportunity to be who I am and don't want me to change and are not putting me up against the wall. And then everything just flows from there, like serendipity, like you said.
Danielle was my boss when I was in DC, and she and I went up to New York to meet with a couple, and I was at that I think I was at about the 10-year mark, but this was at the point in my career where I was actually doing major gift work, where I was doing the very, very intense donor-facing work on a, you know, weekly basis. And we go up, and she's my boss, and she and I go to meet with this couple, live on Fifth Avenue in a penthouse apartment. I'd never been in a place right. like this. And she and I, Danielle and I, go in, and we're sitting down in this couple's living room. And we're trying to be so professional, so what I would call crisp, I guess. You know, we were, but what we were also coming across as is very stiff, very scripted, very stiff. We looked like we were prepared, but there was nothing compelling about this conversation. This conversation wasn't going anywhere very quickly. Mm-hmm. And I remember a point in that conversation where the gentleman basically told us to both relax and to sit back and just have a conversation with him and his wife. And that was one of those moments where I realized, okay, I've got to be real, and they want to be real, and they want me to be real. Right. And so I've always sort of, I even told this to a younger donor here, I don't know, a couple of years ago. I said, you show up real more than you show up crisp, you know.
That's perfect.
They want to see you for who you are, especially, and I guess this is the other thing that this gentleman taught me too, him and his wife. I guess we can't attribute that sort of characteristic to all donors. But I think the ones that are probably going to, again, this gets back to that idea of joy and allow us to be who we want to be and not sort of pigeonhole us into being used car salespeople or something. The people who are actually going to allow us to enjoy our work was this type of gentleman. Does that make sense?
That's perfect sense, you know, and I'm so grateful that people like themselves understand what it means to fundraise. And that's going to include being emotional. And letting yourself flow and just being real, like you said, like, you know, just laying it out there on the line, and we'll go from there.
You know, and this guy knew he was terribly wealthy too. I think that was the other thing is that part of him being real was that he let us know that he knew fully well that I've got wealth, you want some. So there was no hiding. This is what some of the coaching that I do with development officers when they're first couple of years. I say, establish the fact that this person probably has more wealth than you ever will, and be completely okay with it, and even let it be a part of the relationship. This gentleman didn't have any bones about, you know, he wasn't hiding the fact that he had wealth. And he allowed us to sort of explore what would make the most sense with to him. We had some follow-up conversations. I want to say we probably closed $50,000 gift within a couple of weeks. And it was largely because he, going all the way back to that point where he said, sit back and chill out.
Right.
You ever gotten any kind of advice like that from a donor?
Yes, a lot. Which is so wonderful of the donors to take the time to realize that, you know, I'm in a precarious situation, or maybe just feeling intimidated, and they sense that. And, you know, what's been the greatest part of fundraising for me is that I'm not intimidated by their wealth. I'm just happy to be doing my little part, or whatever part you would consider that, as a fundraiser to help other people change their lives. And that's what the donor wants to do. That's what I want to do. And like you've said, it's serendipitous when we're able to sit down and really just flow. I've had plenty of people tell me, sit back, relax, you know.
Right.
And I still do. I mean, every donor meeting is a brand new experience. So
yeah. Yeah. And you just got to show up. So, Jason, I told you before we hit the record button, we lose our listeners in about a half hour. If somebody's listen, I guarantee you there's at least a half a dozen listeners right now that can probably identify with some of the things that you've shared with me today. So if they are and they want to reach out to you, how would you suggest that they do that?
Well, I figured the best way to go about that is to reach out to my LinkedIn profile. It's Jason Butler, and I currently work for the Unique Foundation. And I'm in Atlanta, Georgia. So that information should help them search me out, if that makes sense. And I'm welcome to give an email address if you would like.
Yeah, we'll put that. We'll embed that into the show notes. But one of the things, Jason, too, do you mind? We'll also put some information about your organization as well. Sounds like a fascinating, certainly a worthwhile cause. And what's the website for the organization?
So it's www.uniquefoundation.org, and unique is spelled Y-O-U-N-I-Q-U-E.
There's got to be a story behind that.
Well, I don't know that story, to be honest with you. Why?
Okay, we'll go figure. we got you in trouble. You'll know that by the end of the day, you'll know what the story is. Yes, hey, sir. Jason, it has been a pleasure to have you on the podcast. You're always welcome back.
Oh, thank you, Jason. And the work you're doing is fantastic. It's just amazing to read your book and to learn all this about you and just keep going. I appreciate your help.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank you.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.